Teach Me to Code, episode 42. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This is your host, Charles Max Wood, and this week we're going to be talking about code readability. But before we get started, I want to remind you of our sponsors. First, we have New Relic. New Relic is one of the best application management tools out there. It identifies trouble spots by capturing response times, breaking down your requests, telling you where slowdowns occur, and tracking errors and exceptions. I use New Relic on my Ruby on Rails apps, and I think you ought to try them out. They do Ruby, Java. I think they just recently implemented C++. So, I highly recommend them. Go check them out. And then there's Chargeify.com. And Chargeify is a tool that allows you to manage your charges and subscriptions through an easy-to-use API. And so if you're making charges in your app and you just need a tool like that that can manage that kind of stuff, then check them out at Chargeify.com. And finally, if you need some programming help, maybe some training, coaching, you need somebody to do code reviews for you, feel free to give me a call. My phone number is 801-367-6164. And, I'm always happy to help people out. I've also had a few people, email me with questions and stuff, and I'm happy to answer those as I can. So, again, feel free to reach out to me, and I will be happy to help you out. Now, I'm just going to go into things here. When you talk about code readability, I think most people kind of have a different idea as to what goes into code readability. I mean, some people talk about things like how long your methods or functions are, or naming variables and things like that. And other people talk more about kind of the conceptual level of, how the code's written or why, or things like that. So, I kind of want to get into that discussion and, and break some of this down and really see where you fall and think about what you've been thinking about. So let's talk about some of the, I don't know what to call them, some of the simpler practices, I guess. It's not code concept per se. It's more of a discussion of, what kinds of things people generally accept as good coding practices to make your code readable. And just to kind of underscore this, I was reading a post on the Perl Monks blog, and basically, let me see if I can find this quote here real quick. Here it is. He said, "We write in higher languages so people can understand what we're writing, as well as machine portability and encapsulating big ideas in keywords and idioms. If source code were for computers, we'd write it in machine language." And I think that's really, an important thing is that, we have the higher level languages like Ruby or Java or, whatever your, tool of choice is. We have these tools so that we can write code that we understand, that we enjoy writing, rather than, machine language or, even assembly language, if you want to go, one step higher. And, it's important that we be able to, move along with our code and be able to go back and read our code and understand what we did, or that somebody else can come along and pick it up. And there are a lot of practices that really help with that. Now, one thing that I kind of lean toward as something that's usually a good idea is, just having shorter methods or functions. You get these methods or functions that, kind of like the example that Andy Hunt gave, where he had one for loop that was 5 printed pages long. I mean, that's a little excessive, where if you have a smaller line count with a focused purpose for that method or that function, then it makes it really easy to figure out what that does. And it's something that I also highly recommend to people. Now, there are tools out there in a lot of these languages that will kind of point these things out. It'll say, hey, this line or this method is, more than 8 lines long, and it'll just let you know that so that you can clean it up theoretically. Another thing is the naming conventions, if you're working on a team, typically you'll come up with naming conventions, you'll say, hey, this you know, this kind of method should, you know, be named this way, and this kind of class should be named in this way. Whatever it is that you choose to do, whatever you name things, it should reflect what its responsibility is. So if you name a variable, then it should reflect the data that's stored in the variable. If you're naming a class, then it should respect it should reflect the responsibility of the class. If you're talking about a function or a method, then it should explain the function of that function, or, you know, tell people what it does. Now, I generally like shorter method names, and I will admit that I have, to a fault, actually misnamed methods because I wanted to keep them short rather than make them descriptive. And if you are writing code that you need to be able to use, then I recommend that if you have to, you know, find a way to make it descriptive, you know, without being excessively long. And the reason that I tend to like the shorter names on methods is because they're easier for me to remember. So, I mean, in one case, you know, if I'm looking at the code and it makes a call out to a method, if it has a long but descriptive method name, I know what it does. But if I'm writing code and I have to come up with that method name again, then I don't want to have a method name like find other members who are also sub members of this other set. Because at that point, you know, it's just like, okay, how many modifiers are in there, and how can I possibly remember a 7-word method name? So I think there's a balance there. But, you know, most people tend to lean toward descriptive method names over other method names. Another thing, and this is something that I've noticed that a lot of people have said about readable code, is that you don't need syntax highlighting, or you don't need comments or things like that to figure out what it does. And I don't know if I completely go all the way that far. Now, theoretically, you should be able to look at the code and figure out what it does. But sometimes the problem isn't necessarily that the code isn't written in a readable manner. Rather, it's a problem where you just don't understand the library or domain that, you know, that defines that code. So if you don't understand the problem, or don't understand the problem set that the code is trying to solve, then in a lot of cases what can happen is you can look at the code and you can say, hey, this isn't readable, where in fact the code is readable if you understood what was going on in the code. So if you understood the algorithm, or if you understood the context of the problem, then you could look at it and say, oh, this is really clear. So, you know, don't judge it just by, you know, whether or not you can understand it, but really look at it and determine what it is. Now, if you've made a decision, and this is where I think comments are appropriate, if you make a decision to use a particular function or library or algorithm that typically wouldn't be used in whatever case people are going to think they're seeing, then I think a comment might be appropriate in that case. Because then what you're doing is, instead of saying, hey, this is what the code does, what you're saying is, you can probably figure out what the code does, and you're probably not going to understand why we did it this way, so I'm going to tell you. And those kinds of decisions don't always come across clearly in the code. So that's something that you're going to have to consider when you put it in. Another thing is consistency. Now, you know, this is both in style and in, you know, just general things like indentation, you know, all kinds of things, formatting in general. So, for example, in Ruby, you can define, symbols, you can use strings, a lot of times you can use them interchangeably, you know, and a lot of times if you use strings to represent certain types of data and you use symbols to represent other types of data, that can clear things up. Another example is, You know, there are a lot of different ways to define a method. You know, there are a lot of different ways in Ruby on Rails to access data from a model. And so if you use the same convention through the whole code, then what you wind up doing is you wind up seeing, you know, a consistent representation of, you know, setting attributes or, you know, reading attributes from a model. Another thing, and this is something that, you know, is in this article, he says the lack of clever tricks. And I think that's also interesting, is that a lot of people, they write clever code thinking that it's elegant code. And in the end, what you wind up with is you wind up with something that is written on one line that you could probably break up into three lines and it would probably run just as fast, but somebody would actually be able to figure out what it did. And, you know, I really think that that is important. Another thing that really helps me in my Ruby code is in a lot of cases, what you'll do is you'll define a block with just on the same line as whatever you're calling the block against. And what you'll do is you'll use curly braces and then pipes to denote the arguments that go in. And then, you know, another curly brace to close the block. Where in a lot of cases, if you instead enclose it with a do and then the pipes and then end on a line down, it'll also break that up and make it a little easier to read. I don't always do that. It really depends on what it is. But, you know, it can really help if you, you know, if you can break it up so that people can, you know, parse through it quickly visually. In a lot of cases, it won't make any difference to the machine which way you did it. But it can make it easy for a lot of people to just figure out what's going on. If you go a little bit further into kind of the intent of the code, and this is something that came up in a discussion that I had on Twitter with a couple of friends of mine. One of them, Michael, he, you know, when I asked about this on Twitter, he came up and he said, well, don't use metaprogramming. And in Ruby, basically metaprogramming is the methodologies that allowed you to define code with your code. You know, so anything from a simple eval to actually defining classes and methods and, you know, other constructs on the fly, you know, that's the metaprogramming that he was talking about. And my friend Dave jumped in and said, no. You know, metaprogramming is good. It's a good tool. It's a powerful tool. And basically, you know, the Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. And, you know, in the end, what it came down to was not so much the discussion of, hey, you know, this is something that people shouldn't use because it makes code hard to read. Instead, what it came down to was it's really easy to disguise the intent of your code in the metaprogramming. And so what you need to do is you need to be writing your code in a way that that actually represents what your code is trying to do and gives you an accurate picture. So it kind of accentuates the important parts and, you know, diminishes the prominence of the non-important parts so that you can move ahead and you can say, this is what's important, this is what's going on, and, you know, go ahead that way. Now, another blog that I read, they talked about using a top-down approach. And this is something that I think is important for people to understand exactly how this works. Basically, in a top-down approach, what you do is you don't look at you look at the problem as a whole, okay? But instead of saying, this is the problem as a whole, so I'm going to need these data components, and then if I can link them together this way, then I can make them do the work that I need them to do. And, you know, basically what you've done is you looked at the problem as a whole, and then you approached it bottom up. And what this recommends, and this is something that I actually, you know, try and implement on my own, is you basically start at the highest level of abstraction on your code. So what you do is you say, let's say you're writing code to write to make a sandwich, for lack of a better term, for you know, just as an example. So basically what you're going to do is you're going to say, okay, so, you know, define method, make a sandwich, end method. And then within your method, what you're going to do is you're going to say, get two pieces of bread, and that'll be one method. Spread peanut butter on, spread jelly on, put, you know, put bread together, and you've got a sandwich. So you've got four lines of code there. Now, get two slices of bread isn't a defined method yet. So your code's going to fail. You know, it's not going to do what it's supposed to do. So then what you do is you go to your next level of abstraction. You say, okay, we'll get two pieces of bread. So walk to the fridge, if that's where you keep your bread, or bread box or whatever. You know, pull out bread, open bag, remove two slices of bread, close bag, put bread away, you know, and you're done. You know, and so then you implement the next thing. And so the next thing may be, when you go to the fridge, it's, you know, you're getting into the details now. So it's, you know, turn left, walk 20 meters, you know, and you're getting into these details that the language gives you at that point. And so what that does is, at the top level, you're seeing, get two pieces of bread, spread on peanut butter, spread on jelly, you know, put the pieces of bread together. And so you see the important details there without actually having to understand that the bread box is 20 feet to your left. I guess that would be a large kitchen. Anyway, so that's kind of the idea. And what it does is it forces you to write it in a way that, you know, accurately represents what it's doing. The other thing that they pointed out in the same point, and this is something that I thought was interesting, was that producing unit tests gives you a general idea of how readable your code is. In other words, if your unit tests are really readable and really well defined to tell you what your code is doing, then your code is probably tightly defined and well put together. I'm sorry, I have a little bit of a cold, so if you hear some weird breathing issues, that's what's going on. Another thing, and this is something that Dave always said, he always said, Yagni, you ain't going to need it, or you are not going to need it. And basically the idea is here is, you go in and you start defining a piece of code, and you're starting to think, okay, well, this piece of code would be really useful later on when I'm going to develop this other feature. And so what happens is you make the code at a different level of abstraction than you really need for the feature you're working on. And what that does is, you know, yeah, it makes it more flexible, and gee whiz, you know, when I come back, you know, I can use it in that way. But 99% of the time, you either don't come back and actually use those other features that you built in, or you find out that when you're implementing that other feature that you prepared for, it actually needs something slightly different. So, sorry. I just can't breathe. Anyway, so if you build these features in, all it really does is make that code harder to read. There's more there than's really important. And so it's hard to pick apart the important parts, and it's hard to figure out what it's doing. Another way of saying this is the KISS principle: keep it simple, stupid. You know, it's the same thing. You know, it's, hey, just implement what you need to get the job done. And then if you need the other features later on, you can build them in as part of the feature that you need. Now, another one is just, you know, they pointed out good names. And, you know, I think that we've already gone over that. The last thing, there were 5 points in this article, and I'll link to it in the show notes, is that, let me see how I can explain this. So basically, he says, give a 5 minute explanation test. And so basically what you do is you grab a fellow programmer, you walk them through your code, just real quick and dirty, you know, just at kind of the highest level of abstraction. And then have him look at the code and see if he can explain to you what it means. No, you ask him if he understands the code. There you go. And then if it takes more than 5 minutes for the other programmer to have a high-level idea of the design, then you can assume that your code isn't readable. That's what it is. So basically, you know, hopefully, you know, you can take your code to somebody. You can say, here's what it does. You know, in a nutshell, here's what it does. And then have him look at it and be able to figure out, in general, what it does. And if he can do that, then your code is readable. Now, you know, there are so many other things, you know. One thing that I found on Stack Overflow was that they said to comment judiciously. And in another, you know, in another article that they said, if you have to comment, then you fail to write readable code. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that people kind of throw back and forth about how readable your code is. But ultimately, I think the most important things are is that you put your code together in a way that people will expect to see it. In other words, if you're writing Ruby, generally Rubyists indent two spaces at a time. So it's probably a good idea to do that. You know, follow the general conventions. You know, and do things in a way that somebody who is familiar with the language could just look at it and pick it up. And then the other thing is you know, make sure that, you know, you're keeping things tight, you know, so that you can pick apart the parts that go together and that people can just look at it and, in general, figure out really quickly where the important pieces are and what they do. And that's about all I have time for right now, so I'm going to go ahead and wrap things up. And I'll do that first by reminding you about our sponsors. Hang on, I turned the volume down on this thing. There we go. So anyway, I'd like to thank you for listening to the podcast and invite you to come back and listen again. If you didn't get a chance, there was a great interview last week by Andy Hunt that I want you to go and check out. It's episode 41. And, you know, a lot of people were asking me, how do you do Agile? Can you bring somebody on that can tell us how to do Agile? He told you how to do Agile. He also explains how some of the concepts of going from novice to expert. So, you know, great stuff there. Go check it out. I also appreciate any feedback you can give me. You can leave feedback for the show by calling 801-753-8279. And that's obviously in the U.S. You can email me, chuck@teachmetocode.com. You can also find me on Twitter at CMaxW. You can also leave comments on the webpage at teachmetocode.com/podcast. And there will be show notes up for that as well. Also, I'd like to thank our sponsors, Chargeify.com and NewRelic.com. Check them out. They are just awesome utilities. And things that I think everybody needs to be aware of, at least if you're building things that need them. And in the case of NewRelic.com, if you're not using that or something like it for your application, you know, you're really missing a great tool, because it really does give you an idea of what's happening under the hood. And the only good way to know what's going on in your production application is actually to instrument it like that. So, you know, I just really want you to go check it out. There are other apps that do the same thing. If you don't want to go and use New Relic, you can use Scout or Nagios or, you know, any of these other ones. But New Relic for me has just worked great, so I really recommend that you check them out. Finally, if you have any questions for me that you want, you know, maybe answered on the show or, you know, just answered in general, then go ahead and give me an email, chuck@teachmetocode.com, or find me on Twitter as @CMaxW. And finally, you know, just remember that writing code is the easy part.